Welcome back to the Rev Thinking Podcast, the place where we uncover the creative industry through the voices of its most influential leaders. It's my pleasure today to welcome back Joanne Chan, the global CEO of Turner Duckworth and an Ad Age leading woman. Joanne's approach to leadership and company growth is nothing short of inspirational. With a philosophy deeply rooted in mutual respect, she and her partner have cultivated an environment where team members are motivated to take ownership over their own roles, thereby fueling the company's expansion while maintaining its record of success across multiple offices worldwide. Her strategic emphasis on respect, not only for each other, but also for Turner Duckworth's culture and achievements, enables the company to replicate its success without the need for direct oversight from the top. Since our last interview with her, the creative industry has continued to evolve, presenting new challenges and opportunities for leaders and businesses alike. Today, we're eager to catch up with her to delve into the transitions happening within her company, as well as her insights into the transitions happening within the entire industry. I was eager to find out how her company has navigated these changes under her leadership. Importantly, how does Turner Duckworth continue to uphold its standards of excellence and innovation with this ever-changing landscape? So let's join Joanne and I as we explore these questions and draw from her deep well of experience and intuition about company growth, leadership, and the art of our industry. Here's the question I think is, like, I'm always trying to find where the creative entrepreneur gets their motivation. Because I feel like I've, for the last 20 years, have been a student of, or an inspector of, or a professor of, I don't know which one it is, but trying to find the decision points that creative people make so I can advise them better in the decisions they're making, or build better tools for them, or whatever the things I do as a consultant. But do you have a sense of, like, where in your brain that happens? Like, is it visual first, your vision of leadership or decision-making for business? Or do you have to, like, close off a piece of your brain to do something analytical and then close off a piece of your brain to do something on the creative? Do you have a sense of where it comes from?
So what's interesting is I've been working with creatives my whole career. So the first career, 7 years in the fine arts, you know, at the Guggenheim and art galleries, and then now in the commercial space, right? 27 years with designers, creatives. I am not a creative. I'm a creative thinker, and I create a safe space for creative, and I am a promoter of creative culture, but I don't actually do the creative myself, right? So I don't feel like I need to get into creativity mode. I am often thinking about our culture and the work and how can we facilitate it and how can we advocate for it. So I guess I don't feel like I have to use a different part of my brain to do my kind of general leadership task, if you will. But in terms of how I get inspired, I guess it's changed over my career. So when I first started working at Turner Duckworth, I would get inspired by the work itself. I was on tools. I was, you know, working with the team. I was the client services person. And I would get really enthused when we would nail a brief and the client was happy with the work, and that would sort of get my dopamine flowing. And then when I started moving into new business, I remember kind of running through the studio and, like, literally leaping with joy when we would win a new big account. Like, that would make me feel really inspired because I was helping the agency grow. Now I still, of course, have those same wonderful feelings and celebratory moments, but it's more about the performance of our teams and the people who work at Turner Duckworth, and seeing them flourish and bloom and seeing them elevate. That's what brings me the most joy, I would say. And that's where I kind of have to reach deep to think about how can I help them and how can I inspire them. And that's sometimes really hard. Yeah. Because we're also just dealing with problems a lot. I think sometimes people don't know, as they're reaching up and up, especially in the creative field, that as you go higher, you actually work less on the actual output and you're working more on solving problems for people, for the agency, and thinking about future-proofing and all of those things.
I feel like you and I share responsibility in the industry where we love the creative process. We love the creative person. Mm-hmm. we want to see more creativity out there in your career in the museum space. You know, you are literally giving space for art and actually promoting and being a curator and right. thinking about a collection and these really important big picture ideas of what it means to promote artists and give them their venue. And then now you're in a very practical space of saying, how do I actually have the responsibility? I'll take the responsibility from you, right? I'll think of the business decisions and kind of guide the company in order to finance or support the creative endeavor that we have to go through mm-hmm. as an agency or a creative person. So I'd love that you have a lifetime career of recognizing this creative venture needs someone like you in that space. Do you feel the burden of, like, does it come naturally for you? Is that something you wake up every day and have always wanted to just give that permission to the creative person? Or is it something you've learned?
I guess it comes so naturally for me now because I've been doing it for such a long time, facilitating and supporting artists and creatives. So I guess on some level, you could say, because it's the two careers together, I've been doing this my entire professional life, is helping creatives see their vision through. And as I said, creating a safe space for them, but also giving them everything they need to be successful. And that ranges from making sure that their line managers are doing their jobs, from making sure that the agency is clear on what our mission is and that the kind of clients we're going after. Also for stepping in when we have a client issue or when the work is kind of being diluted by research. You know, so there's so many different ways that I can facilitate creativity and make sure that we have, as a business, all the resources, the people support, all the human capital and the financial capital that we need in order to set them up for success. So I am thinking about that. I guess it's just interesting because when you ask the question, do I wake up thinking about it? I don't. It's just my job. So, yeah. But I wake up thinking about people and I wake up thinking about problem solving pretty much every day. In fact, it's what keeps me up.
Yeah,
what
no doubt.
Sleeping.
And how's it going nowadays? I'm pretty sure that you probably have a lot of those problem solving thoughts more often now than in the past.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as the stakes get higher, it's definitely harder. And I think COVID and some of the stuff that's just going on in the industry, it's presenting issues and bigger problems for us to think about. And how do we future-proof our agency? So yeah, I think the problems are getting slightly more challenging, I would say.
Do you have a team that you run and do that with you? Or are you taking on that responsibility yourself? How do you do that as a global CEO?
It's myself and my partner of 25 years, Sarah Moffitt, who is our global chief creative officer. And she and I run Turner Duckworth as a global company. And we have studios in San Francisco, New York, and London. So whilst we have senior leadership teams running each studio, Sarah and I are in charge of, like, obviously we're ultimately accountable for everything, but we're in charge of the vision for the agency and thinking forward. So in terms of a team, it's Sarah and myself, and then with the support of our SLTs.
That's great. So what's the trick? You know, like, so a lot of people are listening right now thinking, please just tell me the answer so I don't have to think of it myself. You know, what's the trick in processing that or taking on the responsibility and actually enjoying it? Because I'm going to guess you're
right.
You diving into it and solving those problems every day isn't something that feels like a total burden to you.
Well, on a tactical side, just kind of year by year, quarter by quarter, future-proofing is really about pipeline and new business, right? Because without revenue and without growth, we stagnate. So there's that practical side of it. And that's kind of the side that's not necessarily as fun as vision setting, right? But we're always thinking about new business. We're always thinking about how do we rethink how we do business if we're not winning. We are often kind of retrospectively looking at potential new business opportunities that we lost to kind of think about how we could have done better. So there's that practical side about it, and that needs to happen kind of on an ongoing basis, right? We're always thinking about that. We're always trying to be better and be open-minded to think about how we can flex and pivot. And then there are issues that we need to respond to. and think about how we as a company, as an agency, and as a responsibility to our people, how we responded to COVID and working from home, how we responded to George Floyd's murder, and the fact that we needed to do something ourselves because it was a point in time at which there was a reckoning where agencies and all companies really had to do something more externally facing. So there was that. And I'm just choosing certain moments, right? And then there's now, of course, AI, and that's affecting the creative world. So there are sometimes things that happen externally that mean we need to kind of put our attention to it and figure out what is a way that our agency, based on who we are, what we do, our culture, what we're capable of, how we are going to respond and internalize the issue and then figure out how to problem solve from there. And then in terms of future proofing, we also need to think about, this is the more big picture thing that's kind of more interesting and fun and strategic. We have to think about, as every year goes by, we are constantly looking at our competitive landscape and how it's evolving. The Turner Duckworth 10 years ago had a very competitive landscape from 20 years ago. And of course, right now, our competitive landscape is also really different. And then it's evolving even faster. That, I think, is one of the kind of more challenging things, because that kind of change, sometimes we feel like it needs to happen quickly. But we also know that you can't just snap your fingers and make it happen so quickly, because you have to bring everyone else along for the ride, right?
Sure.
So I think that's something that I enjoy doing, but it's also, I think, the most daunting thing.
I was going to say, you know, when you're at the helm, and especially in a time of what feels like disruption, when a technology comes along, it feels like the latest technologies are going to commoditize some of the work that humans have done and make things more efficient, which is also very exciting, open up new gateways that we don't yet understand, which is probably why there might be some fear related to it. We can see the things going away, but we can't yet see the things that are coming about. You know, what I hear in you and what I hear in other leaders is that there's often a sense of knowledge or confidence that a vision will show up. And I often coach entrepreneurs with the thought that what they actually own in their business is the method to solve that problem. They want to own a pipeline. They want to own a capability. They want to own a bunch of computers that render something. And they need that. Those are the tools they need to get the job done. But it's really their problem-solving ability, their creative method to get to the other end of the need of their client, or, you know, the big picture thinking to create new value, to open up some of those gateways that we don't yet know are going to come. That's what you actually own. And when I hear you talk about Turner Duckworth, it seems that you and your team grow and are global because you recognize, like, well, our method does work that way. It actually works that way around the world. You own a method that is systematically works because Joanne's not in every meeting. So there has to be a method that can be passed on to other people.
Yeah. And it's interesting because a lot of agencies will trademark their process and they'll talk about it as if it's something that is kind of intellectual property. And I think for us, we don't pretend that the process is something that is formulaic and that it guarantees success. We don't use that kind of language at all. A lot of it is, to be honest, about instinct, emotion, and knowing something is right because one is very, very practiced at it. And the way I just explained it, it seems really simple and obvious, but, you know, there's the 10,000 hour thing. There's kind of just subject matter expertise and doing something over and over again for a very long time. We gain credibility, we gain confidence, and we gain knowledge and expertise that we can lean on. But I think a lot of agencies kind of try to make it seem a bit more difficult than it really is. I mean, I'm not saying our work is easy, but we don't put up smoke and mirrors in terms of, like, oh, this is our process and there's seven steps and we're going to trademark the name of it. We don't do that. And when we speak about what we do it in a very kind of authentic conversational tone, because that's also how we do our work. And, you know, there's so much talk about data, and I know data is really important, but to be really honest with you, like, data provides insights and helpful things for us to kind of understand about audience and market analysis and things like that that are important to our clients. But data doesn't help us with our creativity.
Right.
And we just published a book called I Love It, What Is It? The Power of Instinct in Design and Branding. And I think it's a good compendium of this great compendium of essays about the power of emotion in design and the power of emotion in brands. And then, of course, that can be complemented by data and research and tools that agencies can use to prove and to provide the clients the confidence that they need. But to be honest, we're all always looking for clients who do not lean too heavily on research and data to make their decisions.
Oh, great. Really? So that's like a vetting process, a qualification process to know that what they're coming for is not a data-driven automation process, but something that requires a human mind, a creative exploration, and that kind of deliverable?
Yeah. I mean, we have so many very large global clients. They're, of course, going to have a data and insights team. They're going to require research. So it's never a kind of a criteria that leads to a deal breaker. But I think when we're engaging with clients and we're talking about data and research, we want to make sure we're asking the right questions and we want to understand how it's being used. I'll just give you an example. There are some clients who use research to determine which design concept they're going to move forward with. And they solely use quantitative research for that. And especially with branding, we don't feel that that is going to prove out what the most successful brand mark or brand identity will be, because you're asking consumers to make that sort of decision. And consumers don't always know, especially when you're trying to revitalize a brand. They're more comfortable with what they're familiar with, right?
Yeah, sure.
So that's just one simple example. But so then what we do is we engage with clients to try to encourage them to use research to help inform the brief and not make it a beauty contest once we're done with the concepts to decide which one to go with.
Nice. I love the term beauty contest. It's not the prettiest pixel kind of a desire at the end.
Right.
It's really the whole concept. Can I ask you just something very practical? Mm-hmm. You know, you're running a global agency. There are many people that desire or are curious, how do you just get outside of your small team? How would I grow to a capacity where I could delegate work to another team member, you know, just in the small space, let alone reach outside of the current office space or reach outside of the current time zone and those things that you guys have been able to accomplish. And even going back to the idea of you're not trademarking or systematizing the results in such a way that it's something you're promoting. You're just a results-driven company and mm-hmm. almost like a good magician. They're not telling you how the trick works. They just say, no, there's a method, but don't you like the surprise at the end? Don't you like the results of the work? If I explained it to you, the magic would go away. Or if I tried to own that piece of it, may not get the same desired results. Practically speaking, how do you actually know all of your teams can get the outcome they need to and deliver every time on a project? How does the responsibility flow from you as the leader down to the team who's actually executing it and giving you confidence they can get it done? Mm-hmm. Is it in your hiring process? Is it in something that's training? Do they have to earn their way up the food chain so they can speak the language and get the same results? So Turner Duckworth has the same desired outcome every time.
I guess we're always looking for talent that will meet the needs of our agency, from creative to account, client services, and then operations to an extent. And we're very clear about what we're hiring for. We've tried to provide as much onboarding and training as we can. And we have a very strong agency culture that is very similar across all of our three studios. And the type of work we do and the way we go about it, again, no TM on the process, but we definitely have a way we go about it that is similar across all three of our studios. So that has been baked in for a very long time. So we train up our newer employees practice, right, by being assigned to projects where they're not the ultimate decision maker. They're not necessarily the creative director. They could be a senior designer or even a junior designer. When we hire creative directors and more senior people, external hires who haven't been with the company for a while, that's an interesting kind of tension, because we're hiring for their expertise and where they've been and what they've done, but we also need to have them wrap their arms around what it is to be Turner Duckworthy and to do the kind of work that Turner Duckworth does.
Yeah. So tell me that one. That's where I want to know, because it's, you're saying, hey, your expertise is what we want, yet we have something we want to teach you in return.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily about teaching, but I guess it's about giving them an understanding of how we work by sharing and by bringing them along in the journey and maybe riding sidecar and making sure they understand that we know there's going to be a period of time during which they're absorbing and kind of taking ownership themselves of our agency's process and our output. I think what's really important is giving people the sense that we do trust them and that we are supporting them. We're going to be there for them if they have a wobble or if they fail. Failure is absolutely necessary and okay in the creative process. You can't do great creative work without failing, meaning trying something that's too far out for the client, right? And to kind of try to push the envelope a little bit. So we allow them to soak up our culture and give them enough tools and time with our teams to get onboarded. And then we see how it goes, right? If it's not going well, or if we feel that someone could be doing better, we just have a conversation and we talk about it. And that's the people management part of it, which I think is challenging in a creative agency, because you want people to be themselves. You want them to bring their whole selves or whatever part of themselves they are wanting to bring to work, that you want them to feel. We want the culture to feel inclusive. And we want everyone to feel comfortable. And we don't want everyone to be the same, homogenous, conform. We want a bunch of weirdos, right?
Yeah, right.
A bunch of people who have their own points of view and bring different things to the table and try to push in different ways. But of course, there is some sort of structure, there has to be, in terms of our creative process. So,
yeah.
But I think there's a lot of room there. And we're also really encouraging, especially in the last couple of years, we encourage especially our senior creatives and our ECDs to try new things. Some of those efforts have been wildly successful, and some of them have been learning moments where then we realize, okay, there's our takeaway. Now, next time, let's try this. So I would say so much of it is creating a safe space for people to do their jobs, making sure that they feel supported. And if they're not kind of getting in the groove, figuring out how to help them and how to set them up for success. And I think that's what Sarah and I do a lot. That maybe is not visible to the entire agency, to every single person, because these things are somewhat, you know, closed door sessions, right?
Yeah.
With people one-on-one. It's an HR performance conversation, or it's just sort of a coaching conversation. So those things are more private. And then you don't sort of broadcast, hey, this is what we're doing. We're trying to make sure this person kind of gets it more. So that part of our jobs is not a public kind of role, right? It's not something that we share openly. It's what people would feel one-on-one as we work with them.
It sounds like there's so much respect in this process. And what it sounds like specifically is who you are as an agency, the process and method you have that guarantees results, who you are in the industry, the person coming in respects that. And the respect that you have something to contribute to them, the ability to give them feedback, and they're not going to push back because they respect the position you've been in and the growth that you have there and the position that they're in. And it sounds like culturally you receive that respect because in response, you respect them. Of course, you're going to make mistakes. We respect that. We recognize that. We hired you for a reason. We're backing you up. This is something that we're fully behind. So hear us in the feedback we're giving you as appreciation for your growth, and not tearing you down or fighting against you or creating some resistance. I think that is such a strong leadership quality to know where that role and line of respect is, and not trying to force something too much, or position yourself too big as a person of importance greater than somebody else. I think respect allows for you to maintain your ground and then also give someone else their ground so that they can thrive as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is it too direct to say, like, is that because of you? is that you've been there a while, you're a major influence in their company. Do you recognize that from where you come and your desire and love for the creative mind and the creative person and giving, you know, the space for that creative process? Do you think that that is a direct influence of you being the CEO and coming through that you've earned your rank? You weren't just hired on as the CEO. You've spent the time there, but do you think that's a result of the time that you spent at Turner Duckworth, and now that you're at the helm, that's a more global opportunity that you have?
I think Sarah and I both together as equals running our business, I think there's some element of being probably women who are more in touch with our soft skills and emotional intelligence. We probably are, and actually Sarah is more of a nurturing person than I am. And we're very, very people focused. Yeah, I think that our leadership style maybe is a bit quieter. You know, we don't walk around with a ton of swagger. We're not self-promoters in the way that I think other agency leaders might be.
I already know the answer to this question, but I almost want to ask the question as an affirmation and just say, and it doesn't weaken you. It doesn't soften you as leaders. It doesn't make the company more weak. And I feel like some leaders want to position themselves in such a strong space because they don't know how respect works. And it sounds like you're very confident in who you are and that you're being aware of EQ and having soft skills doesn't make you soft. It doesn't have to let you be run over. And there are situations where people get run over with soft skills, and there are situations that's not always allowed. So it sounds like you not only have that, but you defend it. It's promoted in a strong way in your culture.
Yeah. We're still, both Sarah and I, extremely confident with our roles and how we show up for our teams, how we show up for clients, how we do new business, how I report up to publicists and group. I will defend Turner Duckworth's culture to the end. We want to still remain fiercely independent, even in a holding company, in terms of our culture and the way we operate. But the way we think about our people and the way we are so accessible to our teams, I know it doesn't exist in all of our competitor agencies. They're not all like that. We definitely like the fact that, and maybe we over-index on it, I don't know, but it doesn't make us less effective leaders. I think sometimes it makes us better leaders that we do listen to what people say. We do take on board feedback. Sometimes that's challenging to us and to some of the decisions we make. And we do hear them out because I think that's really important. You know, our people work ultimately for us and for the agency. And if they have any issues with things that we're doing, we will hear them out and we will pivot and we'll course correct. And maybe sometimes it's just about messaging and maybe sometimes it's about something of substance. But yeah, I think exercising soft skills and people skills and just being human in the way we show up is really, really important. Respect is very important.
I can really appreciate that because it sounds like you and Sarah also have that respect between the two of you, and you can be the example of what you expect within your culture and to have a partner that you can do that with. I work a lot with some business owners and they're the only person at the top. And that's often why they reach out to us, is they want somebody who can feel and act like a partner, someone that can that's up to speed very quickly and can process with them. And I can hear often the challenge of, how do I take more out of that creative entrepreneur and plant that love and respect into the company when they don't have that partner to bounce things off of? So it sounds like you have an opportunity with the partnership that you have to be that role model.
Yeah. And especially because in a creative agency, you really do need the client services account team to work very collaboratively with the creative team. You know, sometimes they butt heads because we're very type A people and they're very type B people. And we want to check things off our list, and creatives are kind of a bit more messy and nonlinear. But it does require partnership across these two key departments, right? And the fact that Sarah and I grew up in our agency in different departments, and we were put in the place of, with no casting vote, you know, leading our agency when David and Bruce stepped down at the end of 2018, they did on purpose because they always ran the agency as partners and they wanted to put two people at the helm who would do something similar and make decisions together in the service of great creative and great culture. Sarah and I don't always start in the same place when we're approaching a problem solving, for example. And I think that's okay. I think disagreeing is okay as long as you have a tremendous amount of respect for the person and their point of view, and you show that respect and you listen. And we talk about this a lot, that we are aware of it. We're very aware that we have different working styles, that we come at problems from different angles, but we have enough practice at working together and we have so much respect for each other because we do, of course, also have swim lanes.
Sure.
That I would say always 100% able to meet somewhere in the middle. Not always in the middle. Sometimes it's more towards one side, but we're always able to do it together. So, you know, we'll lay things out on the table and kind of talk about both our points of view. And then there comes a moment in time in that conversation, sometimes very quickly, and sometimes it takes a little more time. We're kind of one, you know, duo, pair problem solving instead of two people problem solving.
That's wonderful.
We're like this entity.
Yeah. You fuse together. I should say, because some of the listeners might not know this, but we actually have an interview with you before. It's probably 100 episodes ago within our podcast.
Yeah.
And in that episode, you talked about some of the transition of the business and your career. And I just finished a season of this podcast talking about transitions. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to bring in a little bit of the transitions that you've gone through with your business and personally, because I'd say you successfully have done something that few entrepreneurs are allowed to do, which is be acquired, be brought into something, and then beyond the earnout, retain your job and your position and almost be a guardian of the Turner Duckworth culture, stopping a conglomerate, a larger mother entity to come in and change that culture. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to ask the question directly. Do you know why you've done it successfully where others might not? I don't know if you've ever processed that or recognized that. From the outside, I can tell you it doesn't seem to happen as often. And you seem to be an outlier in this transition.
I think from what I've learned being within a holding company and having colleagues in the holding company who were far above my pay grade and who shared with me experiences of other smaller agencies that were acquired by Publicis Group, and they didn't survive. I think part of it is that when the founders stepped down, they put in place two leaders who had been with the agency for a long time. And what often happens with acquisitions is the founders step away, and then they either have to bring in new leadership externally, which then is a strange cultural situation, right? Because the founders leave, and then suddenly it's completely new leadership. Sarah and I were already in not the top leadership roles, but we were already leading the agency when David and Bruce were in their earnout period after the acquisition in 2014. I mean, there was definitely a moment where they went away and then it was our turn to lead, but we were already sort of being tested and put through our paces and we just knew the business because we had helped build it and it was just completely in our DNA. I think we had to learn how to do was really partner to make big decisions together because we weren't yet in that kind of role. In terms of why we have survived, I think it is in part because we've had really good support within Publicis Group. And I have reported up to people who have been great champions of Turner Duckworth's work. Of course, our team, we keep doing great work. So if we weren't doing great work and we didn't continue to do that after the acquisition and after the founders left, we wouldn't have survived. But we have such great teams. People who have been with us for 10 to 15 years even on our SLTs. So I think that sort of legacy that continues to power Turner Duckworth has helped us survive. I did hear from someone at Publicis, who I'm not going to name, who I'm really close with. He said, it's sort of a miracle that we're still around 10 years after acquisition.
That's what I'm saying. You're a miracle.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Because we are still really small. I mean, even just in terms of our revenue compared to other agencies, we're a very small agency. And often, as you can see in WPP and Omnicom, those design agencies just get swallowed up and they become one big agency.
Yeah.
Right? I'm really proud of the fact that so far, touch wood, we still exist. Our brand still exists. Our culture is still intact. And yeah, and that we're still around.
I have archetypes that I use to explain positions you can have after a transition or acquisition. And I've been in the position of almost the three different phases you mentioned. I've worked with agencies to prepare for acquisition or help agencies through the acquisition, mm-hmm. or even been brought in post-acquisition to try to keep the culture intact as that transition's taking place with the earnout happening and leadership changing hands. Like to be a cultural advocate, to be a listener, to remind people of what the magic is, or as I pointed out before, the thing that the company owned, the reason they were acquired, was their method and process to get that creative energy out. And as long as you keep that going, that remains an asset.
Right.
So how do we retain that ability and that asset? The archetype I would use to explain you is the one I call ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that gets to understand the culture and be the ambassador for that culture and be able to share and protect it and not let anyone break that that culture and know specifically what that culture is and why it works. So that if there's any measurement of change, you'd say, no, I'm listening to you. I get the idea and need for evolution. If you've addressed that, that in order to stay alive, I have to evolve. But what Turner Duckworth is, mm-hmm. can't change, so that we can retain that culture. So I love that you've had this expression and this miracle that ambassador role can be successful. I think it's desired.
I love that. That's really nice. I'd like to think that I am an ambassador of Turner Duckworth within Publicis Group. And I'm often in conversations with group where I'm advocating for Turner Duckworth and I am trying to explain what we do and how we're different from other comms agencies. And I'm often playing that role of ambassador. I really love that.
I also, knowing your past of the role that you had in the museum space again, and then what you've done within the business, is that you've really honestly been trained for years before you were given the role of how to be an ambassador, how to be an advocate for mm-hmm. the art, how to be a person understanding the need and then solving that problem so the opportunity of the artist can come out, either corporately in the job right. here or in the museum space. I want people to hear that the career path that you can go on doesn't have to be a pixel moving creative person. It can be a right. creative advocate and a very strong, successful career, and not trying to take over leadership in a power position, but one that's very welcoming and listening and permission giving, mm-hmm. can be very successful. Beyond, you're an outlier. You've succeeded in places that others can't. I just love that we have a role model in you and that's possible to do within a career.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate you seeing that and acknowledging it and naming it. And again, I would just want to credit our team and our people and my partner, Sarah, because I think we all do it together. And without we call ourselves duckies. Without our duckies, I don't know what we would be leading.
Yeah, right.
So I'm happy that you see that. I'm happy that we're still around and I'm happy that we're still relevant and that we're continuing to kind of level up the kind of clients we work with, the kind of work we're doing. And we haven't kind of gone down a road where we're just doing very corporate work that isn't winning awards. We're still very fiercely creative and always try to be brave. And that requires us to, on my side, on the business side, to be advocates, going back to what you said, and to defend the work and try to help clients understand why it's right and why they should go with their gut and not allow research to water things down and not why they should be motivated by fear.
I'm going to say, Joanne, it's only appropriate that after I give you a compliment of being the ambassador, that the next thing you do is thank your team. That is exactly what you would do as an ambassador. That's what I mean. It's who you are, right? And it's why you're winning. I have this explanation of the career, and I call it the four stages of a creative career. And the first stage is the artist stage, where you are the learner. Right. Think about just the person producing the work. You're gaining the skill and you have not as much skill, but a lot of time. So you leverage your time to gain the skill.
Right.
Then there's an auteur stage. And my definition of an auteur is other people do the work, but you get credit for it. So I often say, like, mm-hmm. A Ridley Scott film, it's Ridley Scott gets the name, but there's hundreds of people.
Sure.
Eventually, you have to pick up this thing called other people-ness. where it really is no longer about you, but you grow because you recognize the value and purpose and growth and potential of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost repeat the step like the artist. You're just learning the process, but the term I use there is a curator. So it's imagine focusing on the artist, but it's focusing on the artist, and you gain your value as a curator by allowing more and more artists to get the opportunity to have their work shine. And then you're recognized for your creation ability. And then the last stage is the collector stage. It's when you, out of all the work you've done, you've collected this influence and time and people that love and respect you, and you can depend on them and to have a strong career. I know your career from the previous interview, but even just talking to you today, I can hear the collector in you. I can hear the words of other people and the desire. And you even, when I asked you the question about being practical, about how it worked, you had to think of like, wait, because it's becoming so natural for you. But also said you were trained into it. So there's this like, you've collected this knowledge and now you can just reflect it. You can comfortably just own the thing that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that you're a role model for that as well, just to have a person that's reflected these stages in a very comfortable space and is thriving and helping other people thrive at the same time.
Thank you.
I'm glad we had the conversation today because we didn't get a chance to find the word respect in the previous conversation. Mm-hmm. And in this season, talking about leadership, it's a key word that you're giving us for this season is how to respect and how to be respected because of it. And it does, by giving it, it comes back to you, doesn't it? It has that opportunity to support you and your vision because you're loving and respecting other people and helping them grow. They let you grow.
Yeah, it is so important. And I think about it a lot. I probably experience it more with our senior leadership because we interact with the senior leadership more than the rest of the studio, but then we also have one-on-ones with random, team members getting feedback and so forth. But I would also say on that other side, there's the shadow side of respect as well, about caring so much about respect, is that sometimes leaders are not respected because someone might have an idea about the new policy for hybrid work, for example. And then the way the feedback comes to us, it may not be respectful towards us, and that's okay, because as a leader, you have to be okay with the fact that people aren't always going to agree with your decisions. You have to be okay with that.
Right.
And we have to respect where they're coming from. But at the same time, I think one of the hardest things about leadership and making decisions is that you can't please everyone, right? So you have to make hard decisions that will be beneficial, we believe, to the many, not the few. And you have to be able to hear, opposing views, and you have to be able to talk to people to bring them along on the journey of change management. But there are sometimes those really hard moments where we will catch flack for deciding something that an individual or maybe a group of individuals really are not jazzed about. And that's hard. And I think change management is difficult because, we see just talking to our teams, there's kind of three types of people. One type of person is always open to change and will jump on board because they're curious, they're malleable, they're flexible, and they're excited by change, no matter what it is. Then there are team members who, on the other end of the spectrum, really dig their heels in, do not like change. They're creatures of habit. They want things to stay exactly the same. And no matter what it is, if you're promoting something that's change, their immediate reaction is to say, that's not a good idea. And then there's a lot of people in the middle, right?
Yeah.
Who have, for maybe personal reasons, feelings like they're uncomfortable because it's just scary. Change is scary. It's scary to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the first to admit it. And so they may be the ones who actually need more time to figure out how they fit into change and how change affects them, but they're open to it. It's just they have a lot of questions.
Wow, yeah.
And they want kind of a roadmap on how exactly it's going to work. And you can't always map it out because change happens on a continuum.
Yeah, I personally struggle with sometimes those who want to know every step. And as a leader, you're thinking, I don't know every step. Can't I give you a sense of where we're going or confidence it's going to be okay without drawing it out every step along the way? It's not easy to always come up with all those details. And you want someone to own their own destiny a little bit and say, like, I'll give you some direction, but how about you take some effort to solve this problem and not just leave it all up to me?
That's so true. And that's something that we battle with, that oftentimes if we're sharing something new, like a new approach or a new idea or a new focus for Turner Duckworth, some people react by asking, okay, exactly how is that going to work? Is there a playbook? What are the steps? How is it going to affect my job? Like, they want everything instead of thinking about it as an opportunity to kind of co-author and be one of the people kind of on the journey who contributes to that change. I respect that. Like, there's some people who maybe just aren't, their minds don't work that way, that they're actually team players and they'll do whatever you ask them to do, but they want some direction and they really want to know what are the consequences and how do I get there? And again, I think it's just understanding that even if you have one new policy or one new goal for the agency and for the business, you have to acknowledge that people are going to be affected by it very differently and people are going to respond to it very differently. And as a leader, you need to sometimes have small group conversations or one-on-one conversations with people who might have issues with it and hear them out and understand they're just humans. They're just coming from a point of view. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's they themselves want to advance in their career and they thought we were doing one thing and now we're doing another. Whatever it is, I think sometimes they just want to be heard. And that's something we do allow space for.
Has there ever been a moment where you just had to put your foot down and say, like, hey, I love you and I try for respect, I try to give you your space, but to be honest, this is just how it's going to have to, we're going to have to go down this way. And I'm sorry, you're just wrong, or I don't have the luxury. And, and if you can think of that moment, would you replay it? Would you fix it and try to be more respectful? Or do you recognize there's just moments like that, Tim, and you have to, as a leader, make the decision and know it's okay and people will be hurt or whatever. I don't know if it hurts right now, but people will be annoyed.
We are in the midst of that right now, and I'll tell you what it is.
Sure.
So hybrid work came about after the pandemic, and we came back to work and created a policy 2 days in, 3 days optional work from home. Some people were really excited to come back. Some people were more reluctant because they enjoyed the flexibility and the ability to spend their commute time with their families or working out. And we all did. I mean, we all enjoyed some of the benefits of working from home. But we believe that it is incredibly important for people to be together, at least some of the time. And especially for those who started their careers during the pandemic, they've never known a world in which they had to come to work 5 days a week. You know, for those who were 22, 23, 24 years old, when we hired them during the pandemic, they never held a job where they had to go into the office 5 days a week. And of course, a lot of us have. Yeah,
7 days a week sometimes. Yes.
Exactly. So the 2 days a week thing was, okay, that people kind of accepted. There were definitely grumblings. That's okay. But then Publicis Group, driven by Artur, Publicis CEO, said, 3 days are mandatory. And I want everyone in globally, 100,000 people, on Mondays. And they definitely expected everyone to fall in line. Our team is accustomed to us, again, I'm like the queen of pushback, trying to push back sometimes on Publicis policy and try to kind of find a way to make policy fit the Turner Duckworth culture. And we've been pretty successful at doing that, with obviously full respect to Publicis and the fact that there are just some things you just have to fall in line and do company policies. And oftentimes a lot of them actually benefit us. But in this case, Sarah and I really felt that 3 days a week would be great. To be honest, we thought Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday would be better. But we decided we're just going to do this and we're not going to fight it. We don't really have much of a choice, but I'm certainly not going to escalate it and ask anyone at Publicis if we can change our tour's mandate from Mondays to went to do Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And a lot of people are unhappy with it. And it's been a big adjustment for all of us, myself included. I used to use Mondays as my get shit done day, and working from home, being able to like really be heads down and focused. But we're also seeing that there is a benefit to starting off the week together. And there are still a lot of people who are unhappy about it. I'm sure a couple of people who have left have in part left because of the inflexibility of it. Hmm. Yeah, that's something that has been difficult. And there definitely have been complaints, and we have to stand by it. And we're also admitting that this is all a grand social experiment. We're going to see how it goes. We have some data to show that not everyone's coming in on Mondays, and we'll see what that means in terms of group policies. We're really asking everyone to do it and to comply, and we're doing it ourselves as much as possible. Even though we are global, we are based out of the San Francisco studio, so we try to come in as much as possible on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Sarah and I, even though we work so much also with the New York and the London studio, that it doesn't always make sense because we're working with remote teams. But we try to lead by example and come in those 3 days as much as possible.
That's a great example of just realizing where you, as desirable as it is to listen, to give in, to make a policy that's best fitting for all. Mm-hmm. That sometimes it's like, it's just the answer. And that you have to deal with the quality of business is also something you have to do as a leader and just say,
right,
what am I going to tell you? It's just, it's the way it's going to be. And we have to, and let the individual make a choice, even though that might hurt you, to say, it seems petty over a Monday or Tuesday start week that you're leaving our company after what we've invested in you. But if it is that important to you,
yeah,
I guess we have to move on, and we're in talent acquisition as part of our requirements, and we have to just step up and do it.
Yeah.
I just think that some people know that it would hurt or suck, and so they avoid that. Mm-hmm. And you're basically saying, yeah, sometimes it sucks, but you just got to do it too as part of leadership.
And, you know, maybe it'll change. The policy will change in the future.
Yeah.
That's possible. But right now, this is what we're doing, and we should all really lean in and try it, because we're asking everyone to do it. We have been asked to do it. And, you know, as you say, this is what we're doing. Suck it up.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I do have compassion, because I do know that people who started during the pandemic and who didn't have a job before didn't know what it was like to come in 5 days a week. That to me is kind of bonkers, because I'm such a dinosaur that before the pandemic, it just was inconceivable.
Even more, I don't know if it's a personality type or conditioning, but I wanted to be on set. I wanted to be at the show. I wanted to be in the office. I wanted to grow my career. I wanted exposure to the people. I was hungry for more and more and more of that. So to wish that away for some other convenience, I'm thinking I wouldn't have advanced as quickly if I was only based off of my skill at that time and knowledge and experience at that time, opposed to, I don't know this stuff, but if I stand next to you for 3 weeks, I'll learn a couple of things from you.
Completely agree. I do want to get this message out there to people who don't know what it's like to work in office 5 days a week, that we all learn from each other. And there are moments in the kitchen, there are moments where you walk past someone's desk and you see what's on their monitor. You're like, wow, what is that? If you're siloed and just working on a team and you're not coming into the studio, you're not going to have those moments. You're not going to have those kind of organic, spontaneous moments where you pick up on something that across your early career, if you collect them all, it could be hundreds of thousands of moments that help shape your career. And I think people who are just super focused on the flexibility of work-life balance and all that, that again, you know, we live in a new era now after COVID, that is an expectation. And I appreciate that. And I myself have enjoyed benefits of that. But at the same time, you can hold two truths that aren't exactly aligned. One is that, yes, it's great to have so much flexibility. It is great to be able to, you know, walk your dog, have lunch with your daughter, and, you know, where we don't do that if we're at work in the studio. But at the same time, if you're missing out on these kinds of interpersonal connections and these moments that are not planned, I don't know where these people's careers are going to go if they continue to resist. Because the leaders of today, we were all in 5 days, 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Right? we all dealt with human connections always in person. And so I've had a lot of conversations with thought leaders and other leaders within group and outside of group that we are worried about the next generation of leaders. And we're worried about their ability to connect with people, because I think that's still a very, very human need and requisite to be a good leader.
I'm going to guess there are listeners in the same boat, but all that you've taught us hearing you today, listening to you today is one thing. And we've found some key elements and some things to understand. But I very much desire to just want to watch you for a week. I want to see Joanne at work dealing with the real issue or how you express something, because you have obviously won over people. I want to know the nuance elements of who Joanne is in that space and in those meetings or whatever. And so I still have a desire to want to go into the office and have that opportunity to see you at work. I can't imagine someone at Turner Duckworth not wanting to get to the San Francisco office and find out where you are and just watch you at work, because you are the CEO. You're the global CEO. You know something that they don't know. And if I have a career path I want to emulate, don't I want to be as close to you as possible and be able to see that so I can pick up some of those items and those behavior traits and that exposure to problem solving that I'm not going to get if I zoom in from Tennessee every 3 hours or something like that, only in structured meetings where I don't get to see all, I just see the results of the meetings and not the meeting itself.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I do have one-on-ones. Well, of course, with our SLTs, we have one-on-ones and we also have SLT meetings with each of the studios. And then I myself have one-on-ones with individuals more on the client account side, not just SLT members, but others. But it's interesting. I would say that most people who work at Turner Duckworth probably don't know what Sarah and I do all day because we're not working with them on their projects as much. We're working on other things. Like right now, I would say, so for 2 years, we were working on our book. That took up a lot of time. And that meant we weren't working as much on projects. We were, of course, we were doing that, but there was this kind of side quest that was really time consuming. And then in terms of like leadership and problem solving, a lot of the things that we do, we don't share with the team because they don't need to know. There may be things that don't affect them at all, but it's something that might have been asked of us from group, or it's a new business opportunity and we were assessing it out to make sure that it might be a good fit and it wasn't. So there's no point in really necessarily reporting what we're doing on a daily basis. But what you're saying is interesting when you say like it'd be interesting to watch us work. It's like a lot, even our people don't see us, quote unquote, see us working. They see us in the studio. We're often behind a closed door because we're having conversations with people outside of our studio a lot of the time.
But that's why I chose to be a consultant, so I could be on the other side of the door, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I know we teach our kids this, more is caught than taught, right? So this idea of like, I want to be in the room so I could really know.
Right.
I don't want to be in the room to make the decisions. I want to be in the room so I really understand the decision. So if I had to implement it or roll it out, I know the why behind it. And if I can own that why, I can translate it when necessary and own it myself. And that's the desire I have to, and the desperation I have to be next to somebody in that process.
We do actually practice that. So we encourage all of our teams. Let's say that there's a client presentation. If it's possible, we encourage them to allow every single, you know, junior designer and junior account person to come to every meeting so that they, even if they don't have a speaking role, it's okay. They have to be able to absorb and hear how things are presented. And so we're big believers of bringing everybody along and on the journey whenever possible. And we, you know, we hope that our senior leadership are doing that everywhere and helping people grow, because I think overall, it's really important to give people as much opportunity as possible to elevate in the roles, to gain exposure, to see how conversations happen and to see how we feel difficult questions from clients. All of that is just so important. And I think there's coaching one-on-one where someone can come to you and say, I have this problem. This is how I might approach it. What would you do? What, you know, how would you advise me? But then there's also just witnessing it. Right? There's kind of, as you say, being in the room and seeing how people more senior than you do it. I think that's a really important.
I think it's so interesting that you're saying too, that you're recognizing or having a concern for the next generation of leaders. because of that, passing on that element of decision making and exposure to those decisions that you realize has disappeared. It's not currently available, we should say.
Mm-hmm.
That you're, as a leader, you're recognizing the desire to make new leaders, and you're wondering, where will they come from if it's not from that element?
Mm-hmm.
I love the perspective of leadership that you have and the role model you get to be. And I hope our listeners heard that today, is that the idea of respect, having a big vision, and earning your right to be in the position of making those decisions is really huge. So I appreciate you sharing that with us and our listeners.
Thank you so much. And I loved your insights, and I loved the archetypes. And I thank you for calling me an ambassador. And it's been a pleasure, really. I enjoyed our first one 100 episodes ago, and I enjoyed this one very much. So thanks so much for having me.
Of course. And we'll see you. We'll do it again sometime.
That would be great. I'd love to.
Yeah, me too.
Every 100.
Every 100.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Rev Thinking Podcast. And thank you for being part of this journey where we dive deep into the heart of creativity and the business behind it. If today's conversation inspired you, sparked an idea, or gave you a tool to move forward, please share it with someone else who could benefit from it. Your support helps us reach and empower more creative entrepreneurs just like you. The Rev Thinking Podcast is a product of RevThink and hosted by myself, Tim Thompson, founder and chief revolution thinker at RevThink. Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date with our latest insights, stories, and conversations. And if you're looking to dive deeper into mastering the 7 ingredients of a creative business, visit us at revthink.com. Here you'll find resources, tools, and a community of like-minded business leaders like yourself. If you are a studio owner, join us at revthink.com/community and join our community of over 600 business owners learning, discussing, and sharing life together. At RevThink, we're here to help you thrive in your business, life, and career, because at RevThink, we believe the best way to deal with the future is to create it. So until next time, keep creating, keep innovating, and remember, your best work is yet to come. I want to tell you about a place to connect that you might not know about. It's our online community called Rev Community. It's a great place to get to know other creative business owners like yourself, to share some thought leadership and read other encouragement, to be challenged in this new marketplace, new technology, ideas, economic trends. And it's a place to research. Check out many of the resources we have online, our videos, and of course, this podcast. Join us today at revthink.com/community. If you're a creative studio owner, feel free to join us today at revthink.com/community. I look forward to seeing you there.